All right. So we are officially live with the Presidio Bitcoin Jam. So we've had kind of, we've been operating in stealth mode for several months now.
Since November.
November? Was that when we did the first?
On the down low.
Okay. And we called it Bitcoin Jam. It's like, he had another Bitcoin podcast. Who needs one of those? But now we're actually Presidio Bitcoin Jam, which we were kind of laying the foundation for today. So what is Presidio Bitcoin Jam?
Clearly what the world needs, right? We got a Presidio. We need more of these.
Let's say our audience probably is a mix of people who have been listening to our beta show for the past few months. People have not. People have heard of Presidio Bitcoin and people have not. So let's start with like, what is Presidio Bitcoin maybe?
Yep.
Presidio Bitcoin is a new space in San Francisco in, well, the Presidio. And there's been a group of about 15 of us working out of it the past 2 or 3 months since November. It's intended to be an awesome physical space for Bitcoiners in the San Francisco Bay Area, as well as out-of-town visitors. And we also hope to bridge the gap between Silicon Valley and big tech companies and other important institutions in the Bay Area with Bitcoin. Presidio Bitcoin Jam is going to be a weekly show every Friday, kind of like what we've already been doing. But we've been doing it from Riverside, behind our laptops, remote. And we have been eager to build out the studio we have at Presidio Bitcoin to do it in person. Because it's going to be, we think it'll be a lot better feel.
Yeah. I mean, it's an epic studio too, right?
Like, yeah. I mean, this studio is honestly the nicest thing I've ever seen. So it's yeah, pretty sweet.
Much nicer than sitting on my couch.
Although I'm nostalgic for the early days, of course, but this is, yeah.
And you might notice you don't get to just see our pretty faces, but much prettier is the Golden Gate Bridge in the background. And that's not a fake Golden Gate Bridge like the local TV news
right,
has.
They superimpose. They have like a stage setting.
They have video displays and they superimpose it. This is actually a live shot of the Golden Gate Bridge. So, yeah, we have a wonderful space to do this from. And yeah, let's talk about what's the goal of the show. There's a lot of Bitcoin shows. Why are we doing yet another Bitcoin show?
Yeah. So I think the idea of, you know, we're always chatting about things that we see happening in the world and in the Bitcoin world often. And it seems like it's hard to digest, like, which way is up. When you see something on Twitter, you're not always sure what you should trust and what are the voices saying and who has what motives. And so we end up kind of chatting in our group chat, trying to digest this. Like, is this guy crazy? Is this guy, like, a scammer? Is this thing true? And this is something, you know, obviously Steve and I have done on bikes for 20 years. Max and I have done in the sauna for several years in various formats. So I think this gives us now a place where we can take our group chat and just hang out and talk about and try to digest these things in real time. So like, what happened in the last hours, days, weeks, and can we sort of make sense of the world?
Yeah. And to Steve's point, I don't know if folks heard our live jam that we had what seems like a couple of weeks ago now, or I don't know. All time has been lost for me in the last week. But, you know, I do think there's a really special role for us here in the physical space and with the podcast. And, you know, before 2017, I don't think there was any question that Silicon Valley and San Francisco were really the center of a lot of Bitcoin culture. There was a ton of innovation happening here. That was obviously before all the fork wars and the last big crypto craze. And then I think, you know, for better or for worse, over the last 7 or 8 years, a lot of that energy got diffused around the world, which is good because it makes Bitcoin much more resilient. But at the same time, there's no question that San Francisco and Silicon Valley is still, you know, the densest hub of incredible technical talent, a lot of incredible business talent, and a lot of people that I think, you know, perhaps were excited about Bitcoin, lost their way a little bit, thinking some of the programmable stuff they wanted to do maybe would happen on other chains. Now we're realizing, wait, maybe it was just Bitcoin. Everything's going to happen at higher levels of abstraction. And, you know, if our podcast and our studio can provide a bridge to let, you know, all of the capital, all of the builders come back and build the ideas, like a decentralized namespace, like potentially, you know, agentic beings out there on top of Nostra using Bitcoin and Lightning, I think that's the biggest role that we can play here is, you know, getting those two communities to talk again.
Yeah, I'm super excited for this. As Max just said, you know, at least the three of us and the people who have been involved creating Presidio Bitcoin feel like there can absolutely be a resurgence of Bitcoin culture in the San Francisco Bay Area. I would just double down on the point you made that I think it's great that there's such diffusion of Bitcoin throughout the world. prior to Bitcoin, I worked at Google for almost a decade. And so I've been part of the tech scene for a long time in the Bay Area, as Max and David have as well. But the Bay Area has had a intense concentration of tech in the world, whether it's measured by VC dollars, startups, success outcomes. Great for the Bay Area, but frankly, I don't think it's great for the world. Bitcoin, I've noticed, you know, I've been into Bitcoin on a full-time basis for 8 years now. I've always liked the fact that it's more distributed in the world. As Max said, it's more resilient. It also taps into all the talent around the world. So I'm pro Bitcoin being everywhere. And Spiral, the organization I lead, we fund developers in over 20 countries. That's great. Having said that, we all see the opportunity of so much talent here. The rise of AI is largely happening here. And we see, and we'll be talking about on the show, a lot of the potential overlap between Bitcoin and AI. There's also other, beyond like the big tech companies here, there's other important institutions. Stanford and Berkeley are two world-class premier universities. And in general, I'd say Bitcoin has not tapped into universities worldwide very well, not just the Bay Area, but worldwide. There's many reasons why we can talk about that today or another show, but I think that's the case. Let's start, at least with our effort, let's start and try to bridge the gap with Stanford and Berkeley and maybe convince some students that there's things beyond Ethereum, Solana, and Ripple and other chains that Bitcoin's interesting and sexy and important and valuable. I think we can achieve that here. And then organizations like EFF, which I happened to work with like 20 years ago in my career, and I came away with a great respect for that organization. If you look at EFF's mission, Bitcoin should be aligned with it.
Yeah, totally.
But my understanding of that organization is they are Bitcoin skeptical. I think they're crypto skeptical. They've been bombarded with so many scammy, questionable behavior from other people reaching out to them that they might be in the boat of like Bitcoin's lumped in with all the crypto scams. So I think Presidio Bitcoin, the show, the people who are members here and who visit here,
right,
can help bridge the gap with EFF as well.
What is, and by the way, I've you know, been familiar with EFF kind of at a high level for a long time. I know they sort of have advocacy around privacy kind of online.
Like sort of, you know, liberty, individual rights. Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about
they,
like...
They have a team of both legal experts, like lawyers, mm-hmm. but also technical people. That's one thing I was impressed with when I engaged with them a long time ago when I worked on Google Maps and location services. They taught me a lot about things that we should care about around those privacy and individual rights and stuff. But I was really impressed by, they're not just sharp legal minds, but they really understood the tech better than anyone else I was talking to, like in the media and stuff. So,
do you know where they got their start, by the way? Were they, like, I assume they've been around for 20 plus years, kind of since internet started taking off, really?
I mean, at least 20 years. I don't know.
I would guess 30,
I don't know their
maybe,
origin story.
Okay.
Yeah.
Left to ask.
I think it's a lot of the same, like, early Wired, Kevin Kelly, kind of John Perry Barlow. I would imagine it's from that.
It feels like it's like archive.org adjacent. Is it?
Yeah, and honestly,
to that,
and speaking of which, I think that's another great organization that we should be bonding with. You know, there are so many. I think one thing that's very interesting about the Bay Area as well is that, you know, all of the cypherpunk movement started here. Mm-hmm. Right? Like you got, you know, Chami and Ecash, David Chami was here at Berkeley when that happened. Like most of the guys that were, you know, founding stuff like Wired, EFF, Archive.org, all of those guys are like ideologically super aligned with Bitcoin. I would argue super aligned with Nostr now as well.
Yeah.
And you know, I my girlfriend visited archive.org. I didn't get to go on this trip, but apparently it's super badass inside. And she even mentioned to them, hey, have you heard about Nostr? Like there's people out there doing these things, and she didn't know what they were called, but you know, shout out to Anjali for trying to figure that out. Mm-hmm. But Blossom servers that are trying to keep things stored for a long time. And the guy that answered said, oh, I've heard a little bit about it. Sounds kind of interesting. We'd love to learn more. I could totally see them being someone's like, okay, great. Let's start running, you know, our own Blossom servers to keep this data secure for a long time. I think there's so much of that ethos that, to your point, just got turned off scam after scam. We don't want a token. But I don't know. Like, I don't see any reason they shouldn't be part of our movement.
Right. So I think, and my sense with like tech companies, Silicon Valley, that community in general, and then you have the Bitcoin community, they often don't see eye to eye.
Right.
These are obviously generalizations, but in general, Silicon Valley tech companies look at Bitcoin. They don't know, they don't understand it. A lot of the content that exists doesn't speak to them. It doesn't appeal to them, and they sort of get turned off by it. Other blockchains and cryptocurrencies pattern match better with what they've seen in their career. So it's just easier for them to sort of see potential there. But, you know, we as Bitcoiners, and at least people listening who are Bitcoiners, know that there's pretty fundamental differences between Bitcoin and other blockchains. That said, also, if you look at the Bitcoin community, I think in general, sort of has a skeptic, you know, looks at Silicon Valley with a skeptical eye, you know, views it as sort of elitist, out of touch. They don't understand like problems with money around the world and other people's plight and stuff. And frankly, you know,
it's probably fair.
Like I'll tell my own personal story with like, you know, what's my journey with Bitcoin? I won't tell the whole story, but the relevant point here, 2012, 2013 is when I first learned of it. I was at Google. Colleagues at Google told me about it. I read the white paper. I thought it was I was never a Bitcoin hater. I thought it was like a interesting computer science result.
Yeah.
Invention or whatever, like solving the double spending problem. And
Byzantine generals.
And then So I thought that was interesting. Yeah. And I saw, you know, the price goes up and down a lot, and it just seemed like a casino.
Yeah.
And I moved on because I was busy at work. I had other stuff going on in my life.
And as an employee at Google, you had never been debanked.
And I didn't have problems with money.
Yeah.
I didn't understand the history of money. I didn't appreciate gold the way that I do now.
Yeah.
So that was, and I think that version of me is 90%+ of people in big tech, even today, with the what's happened in the world, what's happened with the development of Bitcoin. So I feel like I can kind of relate there. Having said that, 8 years into my Bitcoin journey, I've personally not been successful convincing many people in Silicon Valley. So hopefully with a lot of other great people at Presidio Bitcoin and with this show and with this space, we can take another crack at it.
And I think part of what we can do, and I know you've talked about wanting to do a lot of hackathons as well, and I think that's something I hope we do with the universities, with other startups, is, you know, to be fair to some of these Silicon Valley folks, I mean, a lot of them did try and use Bitcoin early on, right? Like, I think Stripe was one of the first to accept Bitcoin in, I don't know if it was 2014, 13.
Square did as well.
Yeah, Square was obviously, well, Square.
Early Square.
Early Square obviously grew and stuck with it, which is awesome.
But they removed support in Square.
Oh, they removed and then brought it
back. Like, Square added merchant acceptance of Bitcoin and then removed it because there was no volume.
Got it. Fair enough. Yep. So, okay, so that's a really good example. But then in the case of, like, you know, the Stripe guys, like, they probably were pretty excited about it and then realized, wait, you know, this thing seems like a rock, it's too slow. And, you know, to the point we discussed last time, you know, when I had the blockchain at Berkeley dinner and everyone told me, oh, like, you know, we're getting thrown money from Solana and all this other stuff, so we're building there and Lightning's dead. And so I think, I truly believe a lot of it is just showing people actually know all the things you wanted to do in 2014 with payments that are instant, fast, global. You can do that right now. And oh, by the way, all the cool stuff you want to do with a permissionless, whatever dApp you were trying to design or dissolve, you can do it right now, probably with Nostr, Bitcoin, Lightning. So I do think that part of it's education. I also think, to your point, you know, getting the right voices in here, you know, who have been the successful Silicon Valley sort of orange pillars, probably for the most part, people that came from somewhere else, places like Argentina, where they saw, wait a second, like, we understand why something like gold is important, why having a strong monetary policy is important. So anyways, I think we're going to play a really strong role here. I hope we can. I think it's going to be exciting next couple of years.
And I don't think I digested the importance of gold. And like, when I first heard Bitcoin as digital gold, I was like, I don't really get gold. So why do I want a digital form of the thing I don't get? But I think gold is kind of making a resurgence in the news and the popular mind because of sort of moving from a unipolar to multipolar world, and there's more skepticism around who controls what in global order. So I think gold itself may become a bit of a marketing vehicle for why e-gold is important. But I think it's still like this, where to build is a big question. And I think the where to build question is still not fully answered, right? Because like if it were, none of these anecdotes would make sense. It'd be like, well, everybody's building on this up. But I think the default is we saw Bitcoin and that was cool. Maybe that's like MySpace. Let's go build the Facebook. So they start to try to play at the same layer. But all of technology happens in layers and you build upon the previous layers. You know, you see it with the 7-layer OSI model in networking. You can't build the whole thing at once. You sort of got to build layers. And so if we have a good monetary layer, then we should say, peace, we have a good monetary layer. It doesn't mean there's nothing left to build. I think some people are like, oh, Bitcoin's just HODL and go move on. We want to go places where we can build. Well, good news. There's a lot to be built because we only have that fundamental foundational layer. You've got at least 6 or maybe a dozen more layers to build to make it, you know, like the Lightning stuff that makes it fast, cheap payments, but then also like the applications and the use cases. I think we haven't actually seen a single really great use case at any real scale yet,
yeah.
Right? And so those are going to be invented. The use cases will get invented. You're like, well, why do I need Bitcoin? Why do I need Lightning? I don't have anything to pay for. Coffee works fine. Getting your payment, you know, as an employee, Google works fine. You know, Stripe and Square Block don't have a problem. So there's no volume in POS because like the merchants that are using those are just doing traditional things. It's not really part of the new world. Now, I have a confession to make. You think we're sitting here...
Oh, spicy.
You think we're sitting here and I'm fully engaged in talking to you. But do you know that I'm also programming right now, live? I'm writing new software to deploy.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Are you using Goose?
I'm not using Goose. I'm using Cursor.
Okay.
Ooh. Bad luck.
You're like closed source. I've been messing around with agents, right? Like Replit Agent and AC1 and Bolt.new. And there's a bunch of these kind of agent creative projects that you can do. And you're just like basically prompt an app into existence. I bet you think that that's just like some crazy prototypey thing or just some niche thing. I was actually surveying a founder, not non-Bitcoin, non-AI specific founder that I've been helping out for years. And he just sent me an update on this new product launch. I'm like, how much of this, like, are you using AI tools to build this? And he's like, yeah, actually. And so what's your guess? How much of the code is he...
Measured by lines of code or percentage of time?
Let's say, like, if you ask him
or just sort
time,
of like value to
value,
the project.
Yeah, yeah.
95%.
50%.
It's like 85 to 90%. So that's what he did when I surveyed it. I think I saw Gary Tan from Y Combinator tweeting that they surveyed the whole class, and I think it was 85 to 90%. So of like the current batch of YC companies, 85 to 90% of the code value, time, whatever, input is it's kind of all being done by AI today. There's not like some fantasy in the future that maybe it could be if you squint your eyes. That's actually the way people are delivering products, customer value, revenue traction today. And so
it's crazy.
I am building a game right now.
I think we're supposed to ask what kind of game.
What? No, I'm more curious. How does it integrate Bitcoin payments?
I would like the first thing I do to solve that problem, but I'm just trying to do something that I think it can do versus what I want it to do, right? So in a sense, I want to get there. I tried that with Replit Agent. I tried that with AC1 as a newer one, and it knows what we're talking about. I'm like, hey, like, I want to receive a Lightning payment. And it's like, okay, great. Here's this documentation. Here's what I'm going to do. And it, like, the plan sounds credible, but it doesn't actually deploy software that lets me do the thing with the thing. Yeah, it feels, it's like you interviewed somebody and they interview well, but then when they have the job, they're like, oh, this guy's like kind of lazy, not really doing anything. It can do a lot, but it can't do, I haven't gotten it to do Lightning Bitcoin stuff yet.
All right.
But that's
phase two.
Phase two. So I'm first saying, let's have it do things that I think it probably can do, that like it doesn't need to know how to run a Bitcoin node or connect to somebody's Bitcoin node or Lightning node or something. So let's just get some software built, and then let's figure out how to like get the Lightning connection or the Bitcoin connection. Is it custodial or non-custodial? Is it my wallet? Are they hosting wallet? Like all these questions to answer. So like I'm trying to get something basic up and running and then sort of go from there.
And I think it's interesting to me and exciting because I've seen with a couple of other builders in Silicon Valley who are not Bitcoiners. I wouldn't say they're anti-Bitcoin. They're generally skeptical of all crypto from what I've seen. But I've seen examples now of people saying, oh, yeah, of course it makes sense that you know, autonomous agents are going to use digital money, what's the best example of digital money we have? Bitcoin, right? Like, I don't think anyone in their right mind is out there. I did see a tweet from someone a year ago that was like the worst take of all time, where he's like, oh, we should like form LLCs for the agents. Like, use ACH. Like, okay. But I do think one of the big questions I have is, what is one of the things that those agents will actually need to do payments for? And by the way, to DK's point, if you're a builder out there and you're thinking, hey, everything's already been built, it's like, well, we know the biggest use case for Bitcoin is going to be something that you couldn't do without it. And right now, it seems like the best leading candidate we have is something with agents. You know, we talked last week about evolution and digital life, mm-hmm. you know, using Bitcoin as sort of digital ATP. And, you know, if you wanted to give it a non-custodial wallet and say, go out and figure out your own things, like, that's one very potentially scary, but very promising pathway. But I think a simple one that we didn't talk about last week that I think is worth mentioning is just, do you guys remember Bob gave that talk at Noster Tokyo about Noster Wallet Connect? And his big takeaway was, we need a messaging layer for Lightning payments so we can do one-to-many payments, right? Mm-hmm. And so his whole thing was, you know, even with Lightning, because maybe someone's using Albi and Cash App and Strike, and each of them have a slightly different standard of what they're using. So you know, it's not easy to do a 1 to 100 payment. And he says you can use Noster Wallet Connect to be sort of the Visa or the messaging layer on top of that. Well, that's great. But then what if you take that to the next level and you're like, all right, I want to do like a 1 to 1 million payment. And I want to do that every second programmatically for the next, whatever, 3 months. I think today, and maybe the banking system will catch up, maybe Stripe will figure out some answer, but I don't think anything other than Lightning, potentially eCash based on Lightning, can even hope to answer that question right now. So I think one area that I would be looking if I'm the builder is, if I wanted to do programmatic, extremely high volume and potentially programmable, like strung together payments, I don't know what the use case is exactly yet, but if I need to be able to do like 1,000 different bots in different parts of the world all at the same time, I think Lightning is our only shot right now.
Yeah. And I think that the fact that we don't have the use case is almost like evidence that that's the kind of thing that it would make sense for, right? So I like that. And I think one of the things that I think you touched on with Noster Wallet Connect, but just to clarify, you know, the Swift network is like the messaging network around kind of base layer payments, right? In the traditional world. And I wonder if Noster, in one conception, maybe what really helps Noster kind of get legs is to really be like that messaging network adjacent to Bitcoin.
Definitely.
So in a sense, it's like, it's less of, I mean, it functions really well as kind of an alternative to Twitter or X, but it may be that it really gets turbocharged by the thing where it's desperately needed right now. It's obvious. Like, you don't know if you're going to be censored for speech right now. But if you actually need a way to broadcast that it's going to those, you know, 1,000 different endpoints to pay, maybe that needs to get coordinated over a messaging network. And maybe Noster is that kind of messaging network.
And I think for those who are not as familiar, I know all of us here have spent way too much time in all these communities. But, you know, for those of you who don't know, Noster is public-private key identity and data transfer system. It got really popular when people started talking about it as social media. Personally, that's probably the thing I'm least bullish on, at least in the short term. Mm-hmm. It's great. And, you know, there's, let's say, on the order of tens of thousands of users every week that are doing it. Cool. That's awesome. And that's, as you always call it, the water cooler. But I think you actually wrote an essay that I really liked where you talked about Linux and how people thought Linux was going to be the operating system for the home computer, and it wasn't, but it found product market fit initially as server. And who knows, maybe one day Linux is the operating system for the computer 10, 20 years down the line.
When it is.
Well,
Android.
Oh, fair enough. Okay. Well, at least.
But it's nothing like what we imagined, right?
It's we imagined.
In the 90s.
Linux, kind of.
Yeah. In the 90s, I was like installing Linux and windowing systems and thinking, oh, you know, down with the man, fuck Microsoft, you know? Yeah. And actually, like, it was kind of like, it was like directionally kind of right, but it was like totally wrong. The path was just like totally different.
Totally.
Server one, because of the strength of server, Android one, which is a Linux, and that's like the actual client, is like a totally different device than we originally imagined, and it's a totally different operating system. It's not, I mean, it's Linux based, but it's a totally different, it's not like GNOME or whatever we were using in the 90s, I forget.
Not Richard Stallman. similarly, with Noster here, it's like, well, okay, you had this like kind of nice water cooler build, but like maybe, I mean, honestly, of all the things I'm seeing in Nosterland, there's no question Noster Wallet Connect is getting by far the greatest adoption.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to the Albi team for, you know, initially releasing that. The Mutiny guys have built on it.
Yep.
Bring In, which did some interesting AI stuff the other day, they're now building on it. Like, Zeus just integrated
Primal
it.
Supports.
Primal now supports it, so you can hook that in. Like Nostr Wallet Connect is quickly becoming the standard for Bitcoin Lightning payments, which is very interesting because now it makes a non-custodial wallet for a human or an agent possible.
Yeah.
And when we say they're using it, like high level, what they're doing is they're passing invoices around. Like prior to this, and I know you've got some solutions to this as well, but if I wanted to receive a payment and I'm offline, that doesn't work right now. So you basically use this already online 24/7 set of relays that were designed initially for social media. Now where they're really gaining product market fit is for passing invoices around. Lightspark also adopted this, right? So no one would have seen that coming, including me 2 years ago, right? But now if you have all these people that are running relays are starting to earn money and they're, you know, having success doing that for payments. And then more and more people are like, huh, what's this Nostr thing? I'm already using these relays. Oh, interesting. I can use it to pass other kinds of data around.
Yeah.
Who knows what the next use case is.
Yeah. And it wouldn't surprise me. I saw the stuff Jeff G is working on around private messaging. Mm-hmm. Simplex is another good private messaging product.
Still a terrible name.
Yeah. Who wants herpes? But Steve is cringing.
Just change that name. That
now now I know. The live I couldn't stream. Put my finger on why I stopped using it. Now I know why.
Hopefully don't put anything else on there either.
Yeah, don't touch your skin in contact with that icon. But I think that, you know, it might be that the private messaging use cases that are kind of Nostr adjacent are really one of the things that take us to real scale. So I think there's all kinds of opportunities around this thing. I think a lot of the development community around Nostr is hyper-focused on like one form of what it can be. And I think it's good at that. And I use it for that and like it. But it's like Nostr is so expansive and so general. And actually, I had a guy in here a couple days ago. I think you guys were sick. But
Dan, you've had everybody over.
Yeah, I have people coming in here like every day. We're taking meetings. Everybody's getting to meet Pursuit. I've got two more coming in next week. People who've just loved what's going on here and heard about it. And they're like, how do I get a ticket? How do I get invited? So I'm going to host them here.
The Willy Wonka Pursuit Bitcoin right now.
I'm like the Walmart. Welcome.
That's what we want to see.
But it's a lot of fun. But yes, this guy, he was like, you know, he was a developer at Mozilla for many years. And he like has been looking, you know, he'd been looking for something like Nostr and he just didn't even really know much about it. And he said, oh, isn't Blue Sky is kind of this or something. He's just like, he's very, very smart guy. Very, like extremely intelligent, super technical. Like he gets it when you lay it out. But like the marketing, the media messages are confusing.
Yeah.
Right. And so you hear about something in some, you know, I don't know, where CNN or New York Times has got something about Blue Sky. And you're like, okay, I guess that's the decentralized one. But actually, if you look, you peel back the layers and talk to a technologist about it, obviously Nostr has much more neutral properties and like kind of a better starting point for kind of anybody who's really paid attention. So I continue to be excited about it.
I've heard Blue Sky is gab for lefties. That's a good
right. Yeah, yeah.
That's a good marketing in there.
Yeah, right.
maybe we should talk about the news, but also like what we posted, but also sort of like how we want to go about this show.
Yeah,
as people might see, we just want to have casual conversations with each other about this stuff.
Yeah,
but I think on a week to week basis, during the week we share news we see or new products or technologies or anything ranging from technical to investor policy, all kinds of different angles. And then that's just all possibilities for conversations here.
Yeah.
And we don't want it super structured, but I think we'd be remiss not talking about one of the hottest topics of the past week, the past 24 hours. Which is the strategic Bitcoin reserve.
XRP. Oh, damn. I gotta change my notes.
XRP, the standard.
And this was, I think it's only 24 hours been live, or it was announced, afternoon yesterday sometime?
Yeah.
And then I think right now, not to suggest people tune out of what we're doing, but I think right now there's some big discussion happening. I don't know if they're live casting it or it's just like a private discussion right now.
I would guess
it's Crypto Summit.
I would guess it's private. I don't know.
Okay. But Crypto Summit is happening.
Probably private
right now.
You should stay tuned into this.
Stay tuned into this.
Definitely stay here.
We're public. We'll share the.
But let's talk about what did we. I mean, this discussion started less than a year ago
mm-hmm.
When a group of people in the cryptocurrency and the Bitcoin community started to engage Donald Trump and his candidacy and raised a lot of money for the campaign, had a bunch of asks as well. One of the asks was to create a strategic Bitcoin reserve, which RFK spoke to at the Bitcoin Nashville conference in July with an extremely bold, ambitious plan. And Trump spoke to it with a lighter touch at the same event. And if I recall correctly, Trump said he made no promise about like the government's going to buy Bitcoin.
Right.
I think it was more around, the United States has some Bitcoin that it's seized from criminal activity.
Right.
And its historical policy is to sell that off. And it's done that over the years. And instead of selling that off, keep it. It's a stockpile, reserve, et cetera.
And free Ross.
And what?
And free Ross. Right.
And free Ross was another ask. So ever since then, you know, there's just speculation. Is that like a Bitcoiner fantasy?
Yeah, yeah.
Could it really actually happen at the United States government?
Yes and yes.
And that's sort of been a debate. And Polymarket you can look at Polymarket odds changing over time. And then last weekend, I think on Sunday, Donald Trump posted that there would be a strategic crypto reserve, and it would include Cardano, XRP, and Solana, period.
Right.
Or and others or something, I think. Or including those three, period.
And in the group chat, I said, WTF, what does this mean? And I think you just responded, art of the deal. You know, kind of
I said art of the deal.
Winnie the Pooh with his like black hat. Of the deal. And so what is...
Well, now we actually sort of...
Yeah, I think you were
now
right, but I've never read the book,
I wasn't... people are now scrambling to read the book to understand interpret what's happening.
Yeah.
I think that is sort of what... I mean, I suspect he... I think we know this. He had just met with some donors who probably... hold a lot of those coins, and they probably donated a lot of money. So perhaps that post was like a thank you.
Mm-hmm.
If you read the post, it didn't. It said including those. So it did. And then 45 minutes later, he posted again saying, "Of course, can I have Bitcoin and Ethereum as well?" So what do we know now? President Trump signed an executive order yesterday, so it's official at least from the administration's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Create a strategic Bitcoin reserve. It will retain all Bitcoin that the United States owns and controls right now, which is estimated to be around 200,000 Bitcoin. They also said they need to like audit that account or something.
How is that possible, by the way? How do you not know?
So I
heard a number too that maybe it's only 120 because some is owed to something that was kind of confiscated or held in limbo. Maybe some exchange or something.
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, it could be different departments hold it, so they need to like add it all up. I don't know. With the Bitcoin system as we know and its software, it should be pretty easy to count. And then it should be easier than a Fort Knox exercise. But we also know from like the Silk Road situation, FBI agents are in prison now because they stole the Bitcoin. So, you know, federal employees have stolen Bitcoin.
Right.
Maybe there's more thefts. Who knows?
Right.
But let's just say, I mean, there's so much Bitcoin, perhaps 200,000 that the U.S. owns. The executive order says we're going to change the policy and not auction that off, but keep it. It also reserves a right or to purchase as long as it's budget neutral.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's speculation about what does that mean? Like, what are the tactics that could be done to purchase? Would they require congressional approval or not? If it's budget neutral, maybe not. I don't know. But that would need to be answered. And then do they actually want to do that? Are they just saying that to appease Bitcoin donors and Bitcoiners? Or are they actually going to do that? Unclear. They also announced like a digital asset reserve, which would retain other cryptocurrencies, which I don't think they named specific ones.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they named like only these four others. I think it could be any digital assets the U.S. seizes, it would also be retained, except it is it has a distinct name, a distinct carve out, and a different policy. So with Bitcoin, it's like hold it and never sell. And with the digital assets, it allows for selling.
Mm-hmm.
And
doesn't there, commit
and
there, to.
And it doesn't say that there's any option to buy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a good outcome that there's a very clear difference, because I think people who believe in Bitcoin but think a lot of other stuff is either generally a scam or not really useful, doesn't have a future, or simply maybe even you like some of the other projects like Ethereum or something, but you just don't think it belongs in the United States Reserve. This policy like matched that expectation.
And I think
that hope.
I was surprised to see people coming out of the woodwork. Like, I think the most extreme example is Peter Schiff, right? Who's a huge gold bug. And he's always been a hater on Bitcoin. And when he saw the Trump tweet you referenced, the original one that kind of listed a bunch of different coins, he was like, come on, guys, this is kind of stupid. Bitcoin's obviously the best.
And the Winklevoss twins and Brian Armstrong and people who run businesses that are multi-coin also publicly said this should only be Bitcoin. So
I was impressed. It almost felt, was that coordinated in any way, you think? Or that was just everybody was like, come on, guys.
Well, to Steve's point, if this is Trump, again, doing his anchoring, this guy is a master of like trying to move the Overton window so far out. I doubt it was coordinated. You never know. Uh-huh. Like, it's almost so blatantly corrupt and offensive and horrible to be like, we're going to like buy XRP.
Right.
They're like, when you've got Brian Armstrong being like the strong maxi, you're like, okay, you played your hand very well. It's impressive.
Let's see.
Well, and if they are going to buy a bunch of XRP, why are they not buying tech stocks?
Right. Well, I mean, in that point was made as well. I think you're saying that because most all of the other blockchain projects other than Bitcoin, one lens to view them through is technology plays, technology investments, technology platforms. It's a reason why earlier we said that that's one reason why Silicon Valley can more easily understand those platforms, because it's just closer to their pattern matching. And in fact, a lot of people that we used to work with at Google went to work for Ripple.
And, seriously?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
A lot. I mean, Brad Garlinghouse is the CEO of Ripple, and I worked at Yahoo back in 2005, and he was there then.
didn't he write the peanut butter manifesto? It was kind of famous.
So he came from Yahoo.
Blog, yeah.
Wow. So, people from big tech,
it just feels comfortable to go to Coinbase,
go to like Ripple.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I think the three of us would have, you know, grave questions about Ripple and XR, particularly XR.
That's put gently, yeah.
So, anyway, I think the policy was, pretty much perfect. Like, it politically was perfect, at least.
Yeah.
And that it appeased Bitcoiners for the reasons we already said. Maybe isn't everything that like Brad Garlinghouse or people with Solana bags or Charles Hoskinson, what they want, but at least there's a little bit there for them. And then if you're not in this crypto industry at all, you're just an American citizen. You don't want we're not like increasing the budget.
Right.
Or, you know, taking out debt.
Yeah. Not using taxpayer money to
Bitcoin. And even as a Bitcoiner, I personally, like, I don't think we should put the U.S. in more debt to buy Bitcoin, even if it pumps the price of Bitcoin. I don't think it's good for the United States. And it could lead to like sort of unhealthy balance behavior even within Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I have to agree. I mean, I was also pleasantly surprised after, you know, I expected after the horrible announcement last week to be just like, oh man, like very jaded and sad again. But honestly, this all seems pretty reasonable, pretty rational. You know, David Sacks, whoever got this through, like, you know, pretty well done. I think to me, there's two big interesting sort of questions on how all this plays out. The first is to your point on the budget neutral thing. It's like there's a lot of tactics that could be budget neutral. One that I have that comes to mind immediately, I have no idea if this is kosher or not, but it's like, I wonder what would happen if there was, a department specifically designed to save a whole bunch in our annual budget. Like, I wonder what they could do with the savings there. You know, could some of the DOGE savings be put into this? I don't know. But that was my first immediate thought. I know people have a lot of specific thoughts. I mean, the obvious one is also gold, whether a revaluation of the gold that we have right now or actually just selling gold. If the U.S., this would be an extreme move, but this would be, the moment where we're like, no, we're going, you know, sort of balls to the wall all the way.
Yeah.
If the U.S. sells any gold to buy Bitcoin, man, game over. The hunt is on. I don't think that's going to happen day one, but I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't happen in the future, which gets to my second point, which is I think the bigger thing that's happening here, regardless of whether or not the U.S. buys more, and I bet they will. I mean, to your point, the Treasury Secretary and,
Commerce
Secretary, like,
this is Bessent and Lutnick.
Yeah, like these guys are Bitcoiners. So yeah. I would be surprised if that doesn't happen. But the bigger thing in my mind is this is like a giant green light for adoption everywhere. Like the biggest narrative for the longest time, as you mentioned, you know, our last talk was, is this even going to be legal? It's like, well, now you know it's going to be legal. The U.S. says this is something worth holding. So now every other country in the world is like, wait a second, we know these guys at least going to protect their stack, maybe build it. Shouldn't we be getting our name in there?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you got every state. I think we have, 20 or so now that have bills on the table to buy Bitcoin. Texas already passed it in the Senate. Yeah. Then you've got every, conservative university endowment, pension fund, insurance fund, all of these different giant pools of capital where, the people were very conservative, frankly, like way too risk averse. And now they're going to say, wait a second, maybe yesterday if I bought Bitcoin, I would lose my job. Maybe tomorrow if I don't buy Bitcoin, is my job. Yeah. Like
that captures it perfectly, I think. And that's the big news here is just that there's a huge segment of people who were risk off and thought it was too risky, and now it's flipped. That agree with that. Let's talk a little bit about maybe risks or downsides.
I was gonna say we're kind of there's a jubilant attitude.
So a few areas I think would be interesting to talk about. Nick Carter didn't really like the idea of a strategic reserve, certainly with buying a lot. I think he's more neutral or tolerant on what the retaining what the Bitcoin that the U.S. already has, but like a point he makes is that this notion that the U.S. could be at risk in the future if other countries move first. Bitcoin goes way up in price and value and importance in the world, financial order, geopolitical order, that the U.S. has so many options at its disposal to acquire Bitcoin without having to buy it. It can seize it. And lots of Bitcoin is with custodians in the United States. Lots of Americans own Bitcoin. Lots of mining is in America. Yeah. So none of us want that. It's not the American way to seize property improperly. But that would be an option. And what are scenarios where it becomes super valuable? Some of them is with a strong United States, a strong U.S. dollar still. But others are like the U.S. dollar, like fiat currencies faltering around the world, and maybe the dollar is the last to collapse or something. So that's not we don't want, maybe if that gradually happens over 100 years, that's fine
in
society. But if that were to happen quickly, it would be bad for society.
Super destabilizing.
Very destabilizing. So, in any case, he makes the argument that there's other ways. So he doesn't think the U.S. should be buying Bitcoin. The risk I think we should talk about is, okay, the Bitcoin that the United States has now said they're going to keep is Bitcoin that's seized by criminals, where the U.S. considers criminals. But that the definition of criminals can change over time.
Yep.
Oh, another point that Nick made is that the U.S. could start accepting Bitcoin for tax payments or requiring Bitcoin for tax payments. That's another way the U.S. can obtain Bitcoin, right? So
I saw somebody theorizing that you might not have to pay capital gains on Bitcoin you use to pay taxes, which is an interesting reasonable hypothesis that that could be a way to be a revenue neutral.
Well, I don't understand, but you're still using the Bitcoin to pay cap gains.
So let's say you have some cap gains liability and you owe some amount of money. You can pay that in U.S. dollars if you have them on hand. You can pay it in Bitcoin if you have it on hand. But if you choose to pay it on U.S. dollars, you certainly are not paying capital gains on those U.S. dollars because it's dollars. If you pay it in Bitcoin, they would also say you don't have to pay capital gains on that Bitcoin.
Yeah, which would be a very attractive. So there's a range of options the United States would have to acquire Bitcoin. Some would be attractive propositions to Bitcoin owners, like the one you just mentioned. Others are like very severe and draconian and like un-American. But the one that has already been used is this, you know, seizure of funds. And one thing that
this is like civil asset forfeiture or something else?
Or like Silk Road.
Civil or criminal. Okay.
But both. But the civil asset forfeiture is something that, like, 10 years ago when I was at, or 12 years ago when I was at Google, learned Bitcoin, I'd never heard of that. I hadn't experienced it in my life. I didn't have that pain in my life. Yeah. And one thing I've learned since then is that this is not like just a few anecdotal evidences, but it affects millions of Americans. And there's a tremendous injustice to it.
Are there any top examples? Because I'm familiar with the concept, but I don't know of anybody who's experienced it directly. Are there big categories where these things happen?
In mind or whatever, but I've definitely read a lot of these stories and seen data on the total dollars, and it's substantial.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems so anti-American.
Yeah.
Because if you think about one of the linchpins of American legal system is like due process, right?
Yep.
And it can get frustrating. The legal process can take so long and in America, and like sometimes like maybe the bad guy gets off or whatever, but it's an important protection, and there basically isn't this with civil asset forfeiture. Assets can be seized immediately and then seized for years, and you might not ever get them back.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of crazy. So it's arguably already abused by the government. And it could be abused a lot more. So that's kind of a risk is we look back and be like, oh, we were cheering for this strategic Bitcoin reserve. And then the government over time, new administration or like geopolitics or even in like United States politics changes and they need to, or they think they need to seize more it's bad for Americans, right? And bad for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So that's one risk. Another risk is, we've on past shows, we've talked about ETFs and now we're talking about like the strategic Bitcoin reserve. And, you know, if for people who listen to Michael Saylor and like anyone who's in the number go up camp and like, let's invest in Bitcoin, get rich and awesome. There's like a strong story there. That's often why a lot of people get into Bitcoin. There's nothing wrong with that. I generally believe all that is going to happen. So none of this really surprises me other than it's happening a little faster than maybe I thought. Having said that, if that's the total story of Bitcoin, then I think the Bitcoin experiment will fail.
Yep.
And a very important part of Bitcoin, which I don't think resonates with a lot of people in Silicon Valley instinctively, is the cypherpunk movement, the permissionless and censorship-resistant properties of Bitcoin, the decentralization and why that matters so much and how it is different from other blockchains and the privacy aspects, because a lot of people aren't impacted by any of that.
Yep.
However, even if all you care about is number go up in your investment, those properties matter, because if those properties disappear, then this is just it's a centralized thing that can be controlled by a few entities, and it will be controlled by a few entities because that's human nature. So I think a really important message that will come back to frequently on this show is how usage of Bitcoin beyond store value is crucial. First of all, because we are excited about the potential with that. But secondly, even if all we care about is store value, it is essential for its long-term value. And I think most investors don't get that.
Right.
It would take years and years and years of chipping away or like boiling the frog, basically,
yeah,
before investors would finally realize, oh, it's gone up to a million, but actually the values, the core values disappeared.
Yeah.
So let's not, for the people working on Bitcoin and new people that come into the fold, let's not forget that.
I think it's important, though, to think about this on two fronts. I agree that second risk is a very real risk. And I think we all agree. I mean, part of the reason we're here at Presidio Bitcoin is, you know, talking about hackathons and investing in companies is we want to see this stuff get used. I think two things on that, though. Number one, in the short run, I think we all agree, you know, it is somewhat inevitable. Like the way I think about Bitcoin is, in the sort of Kevin Kelly sense, there are things that are inevitable. Like there are things that flow sort of downstream. One of those things I think is some form of energy-backed money, I think, was inevitable. I think that's what we have with Bitcoin. I think that, you know, you can accelerate things to a degree, but sort of as an example laid out a long time ago, you do have to go through the different phases, right? Like, so collectible, store value, medium of exchange, unit of account. And I think Bitcoin is still pretty squarely, not even a full store value yet. I think it's like almost getting there. And maybe this is the moment. It's like now it's a store value, now that the US government sort of says it is. But to be clear, I mean, we're only whatever, 15, 16 years into this journey. We've got, you know, probably many decades left ahead for it to get to that that sort of complete unit of account or at least medium of exchange. Now, I think there's two things that need to happen along the way to potentially accelerate that and make sure we get to that front. Because to your point, if it gets completely captured by like five institutions before we get there, then it will never live to see that day and the whole thing dies. And like, that's the smart attack against Bitcoin. One is in the short run, when it does, as it is becoming and evolving into a really solid store of value, it needs to be obviously as diffuse as humanly possible. So this is actually another reason it's good the US government isn't like backing up the truck on day one. You know, if I were, I mean, as someone that wants to see Bitcoin succeed, I would want to see as many individual states, both nation states and states within the United States. I want to see as many different pools of capital, as many different businesses as humanly possible buying before the government starts, you know, just digging deep into the jar. And I think one also, you know, underappreciated and an unheralded change I would like to see is, you know, I would love to see every person in the world buy Bitcoin directly. And maybe over time that happens, things like Cash App obviously give access to demographics otherwise wouldn't have access to Bitcoin. And that's awesome. And, you know, I funded now, I think, 7 or 8 exchanges in different countries. And I'm hoping that's going to, you know, end up playing a big role and more people get interested. But if we look at the reality, we're still talking, you know, single, maybe low double digit percentage of total people that, you know, are actually probably going to do this and buy Bitcoin directly. And if they do, they probably keep it on exchanges and, you know, it is what it is. But I think about, you know, some of these potential pension funds, like teachers unions, firefighters unions, all these, you know, old school pools of capital are, you know, excuse my French, but absolutely fucked right now, right? Like right now, there's no way they're going to be able to provide for these people to retire. However, if now it becomes the norm, like we should have single digits of our, you know, total assets under management in Bitcoin, all of those guys are going to get at least some exposure to that, which I think is extremely important to keep things solvent and, you know, not have us descend into chaos if there is a monetary transition. So I think in the short run, the most important thing is as many different businesses and institutions on top of individuals getting it as humanly possible. The second thing, if we want to accelerate Bitcoin, though, actually being used, I think, again, this is where we and other people like us have a major role to play. Like, I don't think we can just force stuff, right? Like, I think we can say, we can talk about, you know, to your point, like Square and Stripe turned on Bitcoin payments early on and it like didn't matter. And, you know, I know people have asked Jack over and over, Jack, when Square Terminal accept? And his point is always like, well, people don't want to use it yet. Like, and that's, you can't force society to go faster than it is. What you can force, though, is figure out what can only be bought or sold in Bitcoin. I think that is the same. If someone is a cypherpunk, someone cares about Bitcoin, the number one most important question, the number one most important thing you can work on right now is what can be bought with Bitcoin or Lightning that can't be bought anywhere else? I think it's going to be something with like this, like, 1 to millions of agent payments. I've had other people talk about incentivized torrents and piracy. Not something I'm going to invest in, but like, that's an idea. But like, if you really want to try and bring the future into the present a little bit faster, you have to find something only Bitcoin.
You referencing, you like with Square and Stripe, you can't force it upon people, made me think of El Salvador. So, you know, that's a country that several years ago passed into law several different aspects of Bitcoin. They bought some Bitcoin. They're doing some mining with a volcanic energy, thermal energy. And then they actually wrote in law, merchants every merchant in the country had to accept Bitcoin. It wasn't optional or encouraged, required.
And it's legal tender, right? So they have to accept.
Yeah. And then, and so that's now partially or fully, or it's unclear, but other recent news is that El Salvador accepted a new loan from the IMF and, it came with conditions, which a lot of loans come with conditions. It's unclear exactly what the story is, though. So at first, like maybe a month or two ago, it was reported that they had to remove the legal tender part. But now it seems more draconian, like they can't buy Bitcoin. There were some kind of divulsion of like citizen data, like their financial data, how much is unclear, to the IMF. Another open question that I haven't seen anyone discuss is like, are all these related to just the loan money or the country as a whole?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. But then the president...
And money is fungible, which makes it kind of weird to be like...
So I don't know. And then, and then Bukele, the president, posted on X like, he's going to keep buying. So, I don't know what the real...
Were they reneging? They were going to get out of the IMF relationship in some way? Or was that kind of on the table, or that happened? Or they peddled it back?
I don't know if this is verified, but what I read is that El Salvador, despite a lot of great marketing about how things have been going, they're in way more debt than they expected.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed the loan.
Mm-hmm.
So... But I bring this up back to the strategic reserve from the U.S. and to the point you raised, Max, about how it's a signal to the rest of the world. First of all, it's acceptable, and it's to hold Bitcoin, or at least Bitcoin's real and authentic.
Right? Yeah.
And it's and then if the IMF has, part of their conditions are Bitcoin's bad, that's sort of at odds with what the move the United States just made.
And is IMF like largely controlled by a big U.S. influence, or is it kind of a...
I don't know who funds it. I would guess U.S. and like Western nations.
Mm-hmm.
This would be a good question to ask Doge.
Yeah.
I think historically the U.S. has been the largest donor, although I'm not sure where this is now, but there's a lot of, let's say, conspiratorial thinking around this as well.
Right. So I'm trying to understand a little bit. Everybody talks strategic Bitcoin reserve, and then there's this distinction made with the stockpile, right? And you sort of highlighted those. And I don't know much about how strategic reserves are used, but in my mind, my mental model is like strategic oil reserve. So if somebody cuts off our access to oil, we have our own oil we can keep operating because we have the strategic oil reserve, right? And so when you have like a good like that is sort of, let's say, like not a networked good, not a monetary good, but it's just like, a consumable resource. That is clear to me kind of why a strategic reserve gives you more sovereignty, autonomy, independence. But in the case of Bitcoin, it doesn't seem to have quite the same property that like oil has. So is it just like a show of power? I guess it's gold in that sense. It's just a show that we have it, so you better listen, and we're gonna
make
loans.
That was a point Nick Carter made, actually, is that and why he's not generally not in favor of a strategic reserve, like whether it's XRP or even Bitcoin. Like, again, the country can just buy it later. It's we're like with oil, if all of a sudden there's a shock to the system and our economy is dependent on having so much oil, if we have no strategic reserve and all of a sudden our importers are not doing business with us, like there's going to be a period of time where we aren't drilling, refining.
Yeah.
We would have to scramble, and it would take months to actually get the oil. So it's important to have a reserve. Whereas if there's some future where there's a scramble to get XRP for national interests, like just buy it on the market.
Well,
Ripple is an American company, just make them print more. Because there's nothing, so that would be actually one difference between XRP and Bitcoin. Like the U.S. absolutely could, force Ripple to print more XRP. Whereas Bitcoin, the U.S. couldn't do that. But it's hard to imagine a future where Bitcoin's so important to national interests where there's not a vibrant free market to buy Bitcoin. Or like we said earlier, see it.
I think this actually hits square on the head why Saylor has been pushing so hard for his framework, first and foremost. And actually, at first, I was kind of like, it sounds like maybe he's just kind of like coming off the Bitcoin thing a little bit. But now I see it a lot more clearly. And I think it's actually kind of a genius move the way he's been pushing it. So for those who haven't heard, Saylor says his first thing is create a distinction between the different kinds of digital assets. And to be clear, you know, so much of the reason that, you know, ex-Google folks in Silicon Valley got confused, because it is confusing, unless you're obsessive and you spend literally years going down the rabbit hole to understand the difference. Well, what is the difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum and XRP? Mm-hmm. This is all boring anyway. What are you talking about? But his whole point is Bitcoin is unique in that it is a digital commodity. And a digital commodity, first of all, has no issuer. This is the only thing that has no issuer. Well, I would actually argue, but Monero is on that list as well. But it's the only one that's being discussed that has no issuer. And that's very important, number one. Number two, he doesn't say this, but I would say this, is that it's energy backed, which means it's literally backed by a commodity, which is electrons or electricity. None of the others are anymore. Ethereum used to be. And so that's the first thing. Then he talks about currencies. Okay, that's things like Tether, dollars, securities, which are, you know, you want to put things on the blockchain, which I still think is pretty silly, but whatever. If you want to put stocks and stuff on there, great. And then he calls them tokens. And I think he does this just to try and kind of be nice and like not completely piss off all the crypto people. But he's like, yeah, the tokens have, you know, some kind of value and they're open, they're run by companies. And I think he even said they're used to raise capital for those that don't have access to the global capital markets. I think that's very generous on his part. I'm not sure if any of these projects besides Bitcoin have any utility. Yes, they've raised a lot of money, other than, I guess, Ethereum for gambling and now Solana for gambling. But I think the important piece is, put all of this aside, if Bitcoin is the only digital commodity, it's backed by a real physical good, electricity, and it has no issuer, then it is distinct than everything else. And I think everyone agrees on that. To your point and what you would actually use it for, because I've heard we have, I don't know if we call it a strategic reserve or what we call it, but like a strategic reserve of like cheese, things like that, like, which sounds kind
of
weird too.
Is that part of the reserve or this? Is the stockpile, because the stockpile is a different thing, right? Do we know the distinction there? Or?
We own cheese as the federal government. I don't know what we call it. But
doesn't Canada have like a maple?
Maple syrup, of course.
Stockpile or reserve?
Both. That's all I got. Anyways, but the broader point is, you know, I actually would maybe push back a little and say there is clear utility for me for the U.S. to have a, let's call it, commodity money in a time of crisis. And I think, you know, I don't know what all the definitions are, but I think gold is similar as well. If you imagine, you know, you said a scenario where we can't get access to oil, which is essentially the basis of our current dollar economic system, in addition to guns, but oil. That's, you know, the Saudis have a deal, or historically used to sell a dollar for oil, yeah. So that's changing. Imagine for a world in the same way that if we can't get access to oil, we want our own oil. Imagine if there was like a giant, you know, God forbid, the terrible crisis, and all of a sudden all of the payment rails are no longer settling. You can't access SWIFT, and there's, you know, giant tension between all of the different four or five major blocks in the world, and you need to be able to like do basic trading between these different blocks. Well, what are you going to use? You're still going to use gold, right? And I would say that gold is valuable. And now in that situation where, you know, the majority of world commerce just comes to a screeching halt, now I would say you need Bitcoin for that world. And if you want to be able to access, even if you want to, you know, look the Bitcoin token, let's say, you need that Bitcoin token to access the Bitcoin network, which, you know, you could look at in its first step as a failsafe. If the world goes multipolar, and if there is, you know, some catastrophic event where all the old networks no longer settle, you better hope your government has some ability to continue to trade.
Yeah, which answers David's question about, like, why is there a strategic reserve? Because it's not really like oil. But I totally agree with what you just said. And, you know, and that, I mean, that's arguably why the U.S., China, Russia have substantial amounts of gold in their reserve. For exactly what you just said, because I know, David, I figured it was on the show or off the show, but a week or two ago, you asked, like, it was when the audit for Fort Knox came up, and it's like, what if we discover we don't have as much as we thought, or there's none there? Like, and doesn't, you ask, like, does it even matter? And I think yes and no. I think no, in that it doesn't matter anymore for how the US dollar works and has value. There's no pegging to gold. And the faith in the U.S. dollar is, I mean, this is not objective, so it's an opinion, but like I mean, no, it's a combination of strength of the U.S. government, the military, the U.S.'s place in the world, and a little bit maybe that they're still gold. But you can probably remove the gold and everything's still fine. Except for some people, if the gold just went missing or gone or whatever, might cause some concern.
Mm-hmm.
But I think more so what Max said about like geopolitics are changing. We can't predict the future, but there's absolutely a potential future where global trade is occurring in currencies other than the dollar.
Right.
And that could include Bitcoin. Bitcoin could become the king there. And in any of those scenarios, obviously every country would want Bitcoin. One thing I wanted to mention, you brought up Sailor. So we were fortunate enough last week at Presidio Bitcoin, we had a launch event on Thursday, which we recorded this show in sort of a special format because we had a live audience in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
We had about 70 people here. It was an amazing audience and mix of people. I'm quite certain it's the first time in history there's been a intimate group of people that included Jack Dorsey, Michael Saylor, and Greg Maxwell. Like, mm-hmm. the three of them usually wouldn't go to the same type of event. They all, and so what I...
And kudos to you for doing it. I think you just opened up Signal and was like, hey, get over here. Right?
Stat.
More or less.
Something like that. but one take, I mean, so I already know them and know other folks there, but like a takeaway I had from sort of hearing from each of them during the event, they come from such different angles on Bitcoin. And the skill set they bring is wildly different. And I think there's a lot of people who are maybe on like Team Jack or Team Sailor, and then they don't like the other's perspective, mm-hmm. or they don't value it.
Right.
But my take is I listen to what Michael Sailor said. I listen to what Jack Dorsey said. I listen to what Greg Maxwell said. I agree with almost everything
I think that
all
they each
three
have,
are saying.
Yeah, merit.
And even though they're coming at it from a very different angle and like one interpretation could be like they're saying totally different things about what is Bitcoin or what's the future. But I think Bitcoin is ultimately going to be everything they're saying. So like Saylor's message is like, you know, there's 50,000 cities. You know, there's so many cities in the world. There's so many countries in the world. There's so many different states and different jurisdictions, different self-sovereign funds. All of them should own Bitcoin. And if they all own Bitcoin, and especially if they actually self-custody it and don't just put it all in the United States in Coinbase or like one company in the U.S., which would not be very, you know, then that's like excellent for decentralization, even though it's entities and not individuals. So I think that's and also because a lot of Bitcoiners like don't like that entities, especially a big entity like the United States government, would own Bitcoin. It's like they consider it the antithesis of Bitcoin, the antithesis of the white paper. But I disagree. I think Bitcoin is permissionless. Yeah. Anyone can own it. Also, if we do realize that future where hundreds of thousands of entities and jurisdictions or millions, if you include like small businesses, millions and millions around the world all own Bitcoin, and especially if they self-custody, that's creates a very strong, vibrant network and system.
Definitely.
At the same time, like if you listen to Jack Dorsey, he emphasizes using Bitcoin payment currency, the title of the Bitcoin white paper, right? And he emphasized that at the event. It's a very different message than Michael Saylor.
Meaning peer-to-peer electronic cash.
Yeah.
Being the,
But I just don't see them at odds. And I often see people getting debates about like, is it a store value or is it a medium exchange? And it's like, and they rage on that. And I'm like, it's both.
Yeah.
Max referred to it earlier. Like it's just, it's a phases. Like it starts as a store of value.
Yeah.
It's because this is not fiat. It wasn't dictated from on high.
Yeah. Nobody said everybody's got to do it. Yeah.
We each organically and opt into the system. So it's going to take time from when it goes from zero to billions of people. It takes time, it takes decades. We're in the second decade. And because of that, we're going to have price volatility. And we are in the midst of this monetization phase and the store value phase. It doesn't perfectly overlap with medium of exchange. But both of those messages, I think, are spot on.
Yeah, I've always thought about Bitcoin as kind of a single player game to start. You may not know anybody else who's a Bitcoiner or who understands Bitcoin, but you learn about it and then you understand it. And then you say, well, I want to own it, hold it, custody it, even if I don't have anything to do with it. Most people in the world don't know about it, don't care about it. So it starts as a single player game. But if it becomes a single player game of 8 billion people, then you can also obviously use it as a payment, you know, use case. So I think it's sort of like it's a little bit advanced to see it as a payment use case from day one when nobody's holding it, right? So Satoshi's mining, you know, Hal Finney's mining, a few people are mining. They're the only ones who can pay each other. Like, you kind of need to start as a single player game, and you can only like graduate to multiplayer game once you have enough players playing single.
And it needs
single.
To be perceived as valuable, right? If you're paying me for something, like I'm selling you a bike or something, like if I don't yet understand or value Bitcoin, why would I want you to give it to me?
Yeah.
And I would argue, though, it's not, I mean, you've made this point before as well. It's not like, oh, it's like phase one, phase two. It's like there's like lots of fits and starts along the way. Like it was peer-to-peer electronic cash for the Silk Road users in 2014, right? And like, there are going to be many niches where as it continues to grow and store value, and this is my point I keep hammering on, is things you can only buy in Bitcoin.
Yeah, yeah.
Incentivized torrents, agents, like that. Yeah. That's where it will get used as peer-to-peer cash first. So I want to ask you guys kind of a bit of a provocative question that just popped in my head, and I'm curious what you think about it, which is, you know, with the announcement of, I guess, states now getting into Bitcoin, it had seemed to me for the longest time that Bitcoin, Lightning Network, Nostr all kind of heralded the coming truth of the book, The Sovereign Individual, which I'm sure you guys are both familiar with, probably both have read. For those of you who don't, the general thesis is cryptography is a technology that gives defense to the individual on the same scale as a nation state, and thus eventually will end, not completely in the nation state, but bring it to the same level of importance as the Catholic Church, which used to be the dominant power in the world, and individuals become much more powerful. With what you're seeing play out with nation states get involved, do you think sovereign individuals still happens? Are we still on track for that? Or maybe you never thought that, or does this not change your opinion at all?
I think we're on track for it, but it could take, you know, the rest of our lives. I wouldn't say I don't think you want it to happen overnight, but I think it could take a long time and probably will take a long time. But, you know, one of my hopes, actually, I was going to ask you, because you mentioned kind of the states buying, but one of my hopes would be that, you know, that sort of the federal government serves things that only the federal government can serve. And more power gets pushed down to the states, and then more power gets pushed down to the cities and to communities. And you know, sort of power can be, you know, instead of being concentrated at the top, it can be diffused so that everybody has. And I think that's a trend that Bitcoin supports and encourages. So you had mentioned briefly the some of the state stuff. Like, do we know it all? And sorry to kind of tangent on your question, but do we know it all what's happening with the state? Like, Lummis bill, and I thought Texas, I saw something.
Max said earlier, the Texas Senate passed bill, but it still has to pass the House, still has to be signed by the governor. But the analysis I read is it's a good chance of that.
And then they're going to have their own strategic Bitcoin reserve for Texas, and they could use their own, you know, state treasury to net buy if they want.
Yeah, that's my understanding. I mean, in theory, yes. I don't know what any specifics of what they're talking about. And I don't know what any of these, I haven't read any of these bills. So maybe it varies a lot by state. Who knows? I think I read Wyoming, though, didn't pass there, somewhat surprisingly, since Senator Lummis is from Wyoming.
Yeah.
And they're generally been on the leading edge of this stuff. But I mean, getting back to Max's question, sovereign individual also, it should, for people not familiar with it, it was written in the 90s.
Yes, right? Crazy.
And it literally predicted Bitcoin.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It didn't call it Bitcoin, but like all of the characteristics of Bitcoin, it predicted in the 90s. Pretty amazing. I agree with what you said, David. So maybe this is not as provocative or controversial as you're hoping for, but I agree that we're sort of on track for it. Absolutely, it's a possible outcome. I agree. We would not want it to be quick because it would be super destabilizing for society. So over decades, we could see it unfold. And we already do see some small examples of this. Like El Salvador was an example, and maybe it's coming to an end. Maybe it was a quick experiment, but like they are offering all kinds of incentives to move there.
Yeah.
Like economic incentives, tax incentives, et cetera, to move there. And so that's one example. And it, we could absolutely see it play out with states in the U.S. as well. I mean, certainly some people's political position is like the federal government should be small and lean and yeah. like reduce it. And like it's responsible for national security and borders yeah. and stuff like that. And that's kind of it. Push the rest of the power down to the states. And the more we would see that, then states are going to compete with each other for citizens, which is the thesis.
That competition is an important part of
the thesis of sovereign yeah. individuals. So I can...
And that's already playing out. Like, I think when COVID happened, you saw a lot of policy differences between states get arbitraged by effectively the sovereign individual set, people who are, you know, have the resources. They'll be like, I don't like what's happening in California. I'm moving to Texas. I'm moving to Florida. I'm moving to Seattle, you know, Washington. So like that's we've already seen that in the last 5 years. Like I'd say a fairly substantial change of location based on policy, which we hadn't really seen before
that's
COVID.
A good point.
But sovereign individuals didn't predict COVID, did it? Did it say anything about pandemics?
No.
I don't remember pandemics.
We'll have to look that up.
I have to look it up. I read it so long ago, but yeah.
I actually think it might have predicted like pandemics.
Uh-huh. Did it use it as like a motivating factor for any of the theses in the book?
I'm curious.
Now I want to get on like an LLM and ask.
Though.
Yeah. Do you guys read books with LLMs now?
No.
What do you mean, like summarize?
Yeah, like, well, right now...
I love learning about...
New ways to use LLM.
New ways to use LLM.
I mean, I've heard people talking about it recently, and right now my mind is going to like, as soon as we click stop on this thing, I'm going to go and I want to hit like, you know, Grok or something. Like, does sovereign individual have anything to say about, you know, about, sorry, what was the one that we have in our survey? Yeah, pandemics and sort of how did it play out and how did it relate to COVID? And I bet we'd have a great LLM result where it would be able to explain, well, here's what it said, and it was kind of right on this and kind of wrong on that.
Which also, a little off topic, but makes me just think, as bullish as I am on AI, in many ways, it's literally just contextual search. Like, I'm thinking, like, really, like, one of the main use cases we're coming up with here, and obviously there'll be a lot of cool things, but is the same use case of, like, you know, 1995. You're like, hey, man, what... I don't know, like, what's the state capital of whatever of I don't know.
Dude, you're crazy.
Kazakhstan.
I am literally building a video game while we talk.
That's fair. But hey, those little people on Google, I can tell you right now.
I know there's at least one other topic we were hoping to cover. Let's talk about it. We only have a few minutes left.
Yeah.
But let's touch on it.
I like this. Steve is a host. This is
it's
good.
Gonna
easier.
Yeah, sorry,
easier. I appreciate
it.
It's fun.
Taking over your job.
You're too busy programming.
this is a peer
it's
based.
Supposed to be, yeah.
There was a recent, I think it was on CNN or some article written that was critical about Bitcoin mining and the environment.
Oh, here we go.
But what made this? There's many such articles the past 10 years. It tends to come in waves, typically when there's a bull cycle, when there's just more public interest and the price is going up and people are getting wealthy and stuff, then there's more articles that are critical, which in general is fair and good.
Yeah.
We should, any kind of movement or technology or system, we should critically look at. But we haven't really seen much criticism over environment and energy. 2021 was like really intense, and Max and I worked on a paper. I mean, Max wrote the paper, but I worked with Max on it. I reviewed the paper. But Max and I spoke a lot about it in 2021, engaged with different sets of folks, you know, generally leveled up our knowledge, know a lot about that, and we're both strong advocates. I mean, not just for Bitcoin, but Bitcoin mining, and that it not only is not bad for the environment, but it actually can be a net positive for renewable energy, solar energy, which was the sort of the thesis for Max's paper. We don't have enough time to go into that paper. I just found it interesting that there is a recent article that criticized it was bad. I forget the country they're referring to, but it was like bad for their citizens. And like stealing all the hydropower, like, you know, basically like Bitcoin mining was taking all the hydropower away from citizens. And maybe there's like one anecdotal case of that happening temporarily or something, but it's certainly not a comprehensive view. And it's also just so detached from the reality of the economics and the incentives,
mm-hmm.
because everyone should understand Bitcoin mining is the most competitive cutthroat industry in the history
of
the
brutal.
World.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because there's almost no barriers to entering, and it's global. And it's designed so that there's not a centralization of power. So,
even though you could argue we have some various centralizing forces today, but in the long run, this goes to the places where you can't do anything else with
electricity.
Where you can't do anything else with it.
The driving factor is cheap electricity, which is very globally dispersed, especially as we tap into renewable resources like the sun shines everywhere in the world. Rivers flowing and water flowing is all over the world. Wind blows all over the world. It varies, of course, but it's not like one country dominates those energy sources, right? So, but Bitcoin, there's not software written preferring oil or wind or sun. It's agnostic to the source of energy. It just wants cheap energy. Or even Bitcoin doesn't want that, but the businesses running this are single-handedly incentivized to seek out cheap energy. Max is a very strong proponent of cheap energy is going to be renewable, and in particular solar, but you know, renewable in general. I think most people agree that long-term, it will be the cheapest source of energy. It hasn't in the past. Today, there's like situations where it is and situations where it isn't.
The energy in fossil fuels comes from the sun. Right.
It's all, yes, but, of course.
Well, but renewable and sustainable, I think, is the important tag there. But
my point is, like, anything else besides going directly to the sun is just another step along the process, right?
My point, so Bitcoin miners, Bitcoin businesses are going to seek out cheap energy. Over time, that will be sustainable energy. And in the cases where it's not, it's not like Bitcoin's evil. It's up to human beings saying like, okay, we want to create policies around taxing or economically disincentivizing non-renewable sources. They can do that and Bitcoin automatically adjusts. Yep. If all of a sudden it costs more to mine with coal, then the mining moves.
Yeah.
And the point I was going to make about like stealing energy from a local citizenry, Bitcoin mining globally right now generally needs like 4 cent to 6 cent power, like per kilowatt hour.
Mm-hmm.
Like nearly everywhere in the world, retail, consumers, individual, like families pay way more than that. Certainly here in California, even back where I'm from in Iowa or like maybe
anywhere,
in the South or whatever, it's way more expensive than 4 cents. So miners aren't willing to pay that. So miners aren't stealing energy from it. They're only using energy that no one else is willing to pay or that there's not demand. And in the case of hydro in particular, there's so much wasted stranded energy. Water's flowing over a waterfall or whatever, and that energy is generated and then it's not used. So it just is appalling to me. The media coverage is so imbalanced on that topic. And yeah, I mean, we can use many shows to go deep dives.
We should do a show to revisit the paper, see what's right, what's wrong, what hasn't changed, and what has. But one point I'll just add on that: there's a lot we can say about, like, I actually think that it's a natural or almost temporal process. Like, I think the fossil fuels were a battery. Now the Earth is about to jump into its next phase. You know, if we kind of ascend the Kardashev scale, we've used up our battery. Now it's time to use the energy of the sun, and I think it's all happening very naturally. But the thing that I guess is crazy to me is, you know, these sort of hit pieces have been coming for years and years. 21 was obviously like a height of it all. And, you know, I tried to even read the piece that you shared on there, and like it was behind a CNN paywall. So, like,
I know I got like attacked by ads and all these things, GDPR. And I was like, okay, Steve can just give us the.
Try
why are you reading mainstream media anyway?
You're not a subscriber to CNN.
Shockingly, no. But the thing that I guess is crazy to me is just, you know, at some point, you know, I do wonder, is this misinformed or is it malicious? Either way, it's messed up. But, you know, even bringing that up in a day and age where AI compute usage is like so much more than
that was another reason I was shocked.
It's just also like
to see it now.
Dude, are you serious? Like, Anyway, so we should do a whole show on this, yeah, a recap, but like it's I think it's now such a bad look for them that anyone with like two brain cells is starting to realize, wait, these guys are either radically misinformed, in which case I should unsubscribe, or they're actively out to lie, yeah, in which case, yeah, I should probably sue.
But let's definitely cover it in a future show extensively, because I do think that the audience we're trying to reach, like people at Google and Big Tech, a lot, if you don't spend time studying this and you just read headlines,
yep,
or you read these articles,
yep,
it sounds awful,
yeah,
the way it's spun. And it's just so horribly treated in the balance of coverage. So we'll look forward to talking about it,
yeah,
in the future,
next time,
your show.
All right. Well, I hope it happens in the news, because we are kind of on a little bit of a current events theme, and it feels like there's so much chaos going in the world that we're never going to run out of current weekly, daily things to talk about.
What happens in April, right?
What's April?
What's April?
Earth Day.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that brings a lot of attention and highlights the environment.
You're going to say taxes or
climate change. Oh, my God. That too.
A few fun things.
So I suspect there'll be a natural way, a current event that will be on topic.
And hopefully, I believe Austin is talking with getting Ali back in here to do another, maybe we'll get a couple other folks into another great sort of Earth Day event at City of Bitcoin.
So. Yeah.
Awesome.
Awesome. Lots of events coming up here too, right? So stay tuned. We're going to talk about what's happening next. We should announce them here. This is Presidio Bitcoin.
Yeah.
All right.
That's what's up.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Till next time.
Bye-bye.
Peace.